Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Kamidobu podcast. I am Christopher Beljanovsky, and joining me in the virtual podcasting booth, as always, is the man, the myth, the legend, Toasty.
Toasty!
Thank you for joining us for another great episode. As fans of the franchise since the beginning, it's been a dream come true to bring this podcast to you all these past 3 years. If you're new here, feel free to give us a follow or subscribe wherever you watch or listen to the podcast so that you don't miss another episode. I know Toasty is eager to get started, so take it away, my brother.
Thank you so much for being here today. There are all kinds of intriguing combatants in the Mortal Kombat lore. I'll never forget one of my favorite newcomers in Mortal Kombat 4, playing in the arcades with my father, Quan Chi. He had an incredible design, was super intimidating, a master of dark magic, and his connection with the Brotherhood of Shadow alongside Shinnok was most fascinating. Quan Chi grew to be my absolute favorite character, and it was so nice to see him in the newer games as well. We've had some wonderful people portray him, but one of the most iconic voices is that of Ronald M. Banks, who played this famous character in Mortal Kombat vs. DC, Mortal Kombat 2011, and Mortal Kombat X. Ronald continued to impress fans around the globe with his memorable performance, and so therefore, we are most grateful to have him on the show today. Let's talk more in depth about the Master of Necromancy and how Ron's experience was like behind the scenes. And away we go to today's interview. All right, everybody, and here we are, joined by Ronald M. Banks. Thank you so much for being here. I am a colossal Quan Chi fan. This is a big deal.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's such an honor to be able to share this time with you guys.
Excellent. So to start off today, Ron, how about you elaborate on how you fell into the acting business in the first place, considering you originally took on the role of a nurse after high school?
Yes. Well, I was working as a nurse, and I just sort of felt like there was something missing in my life. And I had grown up shy, and I figured a great way to get out of being shy was to become an actor. So I started... I went to a little school. I grew up in San Diego, and there's a town outside called La Mesa, and they had little drama schools run by one woman, just a little black box of a storefront. And I worked with her for a few weeks, and she started to send me out on auditions for community productions. Mm. And that's really how I started. I kind of got on-the-job experience. Later on, I found out I could sing. I auditioned for a musical with the one song I happened to know at the time, because right then I was still an actor. It was for Flower Drum Song at a place called Starlight down there. And I got cast.
Wow.
Before I knew it, people were asking me to do things like join the opera chorus. And I did that.
Wow.
Yeah, right after my one foray into musical theater. And I spent the next 20 years trying to have an opera career. And it was, you know, it was 20 years of paying my dues and also working community theater. And my first love was still musical theater, but it allowed me to build a vocal technique that gave me a very strong voice. That while it wasn't much use in opera, my particular voice type, there's just a lot of people. So it's very, very difficult to get a job. My big break came in 1998. And, the director who cast me in that original show remembered me 20 years later, and he was putting up King and I, and he needed a king. And that was my big break. Uh-huh. I performed the role of the king for a few months, got my equity card, and before I knew it, I had a career.
Unreal.
Very nice.
And
very
during
nice.
That entire time, all the time I was paying my dues, I was still working as a nurse on the night shift. That way I could afford... Yeah, I mean, you have to do it. I tell young kids today, if you're going to work, I don't want to say get a real job, but you want something that pays, because starving artist is sort of a literary metaphor for overcoming struggles, but man, oh man, if you don't have money to pay for lessons and gas to get to auditions, you're just making it really hard on yourself.
So it's not cheap.
No.
Yeah. So technically speaking, Midway Games were the first to offer you the role of Quan Chi. She was originally planned as a downloadable character in Mortal Kombat vs. DC Universe, but that was ultimately scrapped. Tell us about the day when you were offered the role of Quan Chi, and was it a bit of a hill to climb to get there, or was it pretty smooth sailing?
Well, I had worked in musical theater for probably 10 years before I even started working in voiceover. And I ended up at Disney doing Jafar and the Aladdin show. And people kept telling me, hey, you know, you have a nice voice. You should get into voiceover. So I asked one of the guys who's playing the genie, well, who's your voiceover? How did you get into voiceover? And he sent me over to a place called Brain Tracks, Nancy Wilson's outfit. And I took training for her for about a year, got my demo. And my agent at the time, he found out wasn't the first thing I did was call my agent and say, hey, I'm training as a voiceover artist. He just happened to find out and started sending me on calls. And back then, it's not like it is today where you know, I got a little studio up in my wife's walk-in closet for all of my auditions. More about that later, but back then I had to drive up to LA or Santa Monica or Sepulveda Valley and do an actual audition for it. And right. I started to do a lot of them, and I wish I could tell you that the heavens opened up when I got the Quan Chi gig. A couple of reasons for that. As a working actor, you just get yourself out there and you just audition and audition and audition, and when you start to become successful, plus I'm old now and my brain is a little bit fried, the exact details don't always come back to you. And I'm so embarrassed to admit this, but at the time I didn't play a lot of computer games and I never was a console player. I mean, my wife and I have gotten into it now.
World of Warcraft. MMO.
Yeah, World of Warcraft and yeah. Neverwinter Nights, and lately we've been going to ESO, Elder Scrolls Online. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah. So that's where we were. But we had a Wii, and I think her brother gave us a Microsoft. No, not the Xbox, the other one, the PlayStation. Gave us a PlayStation. Yeah. So we did a little bit of that, but I didn't have a big familiarity with that. I had my foot firmly in musical theater. And so when the gig came along, I was happy, but I didn't know the impact of it, all of which I learned later in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
It was still great to get the job, absolutely, don't get me wrong. And back then, Mortal Kombat versus the DC Universe, the pay was okay. Yeah. But when they got bought out by Warner Brothers and they invited me back for Mortal Kombat in 2011 and Mortal Kombat X, the pay was a little more eye-popping, so.
I bet.
Did you report much for that game, or? Because I guess it was a role that was ultimately scrapped, but was there much actually recorded that was sort of tossed out, or?
DC Universe?
Yeah.
I was able to actually, every single time I read for the role of Quan Chi, we were able to complete it in one session.
Okay.
And I wasn't overly long, as I recall. It was a few hours. But I assume, you know, once I book these gigs, I assume I'm going to be there for the day. So,
sure. Mm-hmm.
If nothing else, just driving up to LA and back. I live in Orange County. That makes it sort of a day-long odyssey.
After winning the role, did you happen to do any type of research in terms of the character's lore? Did you perhaps watch history videos online? Were you aware of Quan Chi and Scorpion's rivalry, etc.?
No, I wasn't, actually, which... You ever watch talk shows where actors talk about their process, and one actor is like... They get into every detail and they study the history. And normally I would do that, but I didn't really know what to expect. And back then was not as yeah, I didn't know what to expect. And
okay.
I figured they saw something in my voice or heard something in my voice and my resume that made them think that I could be a good fit for the role. And when I first started to audition, I had finished doing a lot of King and I's, and as Quan Chi is an Asian-sounding name, I started to record with an Asian accent. My heritage is Japanese, and I played the King a lot in the King and I, and that is sort of a quasi-Asian accent, not specific to any real country. And they said, oh, no, wait, just do him regularly, do him with an American accent, and yeah. So I did. So I kind of learned about Mortal Kombat as I got more into doing the role itself. And it would come, you know, like every few years, so it wasn't at the top of my mind at the time. Again, working actor, you give everything you can to the project you're on, and then you move on to the next project.
Yeah. Could you give us a sample of what you sort of sounded like, your first initial take on Quan Chi with the Asian accent? Like,
It was something like, you are part of general plan I have for bringing to Siam what is good in Western culture. I have already bring here printing press for printing. So very, you know,
okay.
Kind of quasi-Asian, a little bit Japanese.
Yeah.
Some. I grew up with that accent a little bit. As a child, mostly from my great grandmother, but our family was pretty Americanized. So,
I have a question.
It wasn't until later that I realized that, looking up, and even in just preparation for this this podcast, I looked up and didn't realize that Quan Chi, his look was actually modeled after Yul Brynner, who played the King in The King and I. So the connections are just amazing, but. In regards to preparing for these kinds of roles, a couple of things. I guess I was the kind of actor that didn't prepare a lot because, one, I didn't want to end up copying. I had sort of had an experience with that by doing The King and The King and I, a role that was so strongly identified with Yul Brynner. But an actor doesn't want to go out on stage and do an impersonation unless they're hired to do that. And I studied it, and then in my interpretation, I gave a nod to his performance, but then tried to make it my own. I did the same thing with Quan Chi. And as you probably know, they don't give us the copy ahead of time. I got into the booth, they handed me the copy, and then told me the story. So I had, you know, and they didn't spend any time saying, okay, well, Quan Chi's went to Tahiti and now he's back. And, you know, they didn't give me any backstory on what he had been doing up to that point or anything like that. It was just, here's these lines. This is the interpretation we're looking for. For me, I kind of like that because my first impression of what I'm reading in the context of the script, and I can come, whatever backstory I come up with, it's still going through me. And it seems like the readings are fresher, and the director picks those, the early ones. When I have to start really going over them multiple times, I'm sorry, I'm one of those guys that gets worse with practice. It's just, you know, because you get in your own head, and then you, okay, the director asked for this, and so I'm giving him this. Oops, now I didn't give him the other quality of the read, the part that he liked. And it just, oh my goodness. So that's something I still have to work on. So I hope casting directors aren't watching this because
I hear you, man. I hear you. speaking of when you did the role of the King, I believe you performed that over 500 times. Is that accurate?
I did. Yes. Wow. It tours, regional productions, two-year national tour. With Sandy Duncan and Stephanie Powers. I didn't play the King then. I played the Colahome, but it's like being there. I understudied the King, so it's still like being a part of that story. But yeah, it is my favorite role, and I could do it for decades more and still find something new in every performance. He was so complex and so...
Sure.
the story is so intriguing, the clashing of cultures. And right now, with what's going on in the world, a story about how cultures come together and find similarities, I think, is very important for all of us, the whole world.
So when it comes to Quan Chi, what in your mind makes him so special compared to the other combatants? What really drew you to him, and what are some of your favorite, say, special abilities of his?
Yikes. So have you seen that there's an interview done by the newspaper of Orange Coast College? And it was a video interview of me as a voiceover artist, and they liked the fact that I played Quan Chi. They also liked the fact that I knew nothing about him because I'd never played the game. So if you go to that video, part of the interview is they brought their whole rig and a widescreen TV over and their Xbox and gave me the console, and they set me up to play the game and give my comments on it. So that was the very first time that I ever played the game. So when I did DC Universe, I didn't know. I knew Mortal Kombat was a video game, a computer game, a console game, but that's about it. But I had I'd spent so much time. I had gotten the role of Jafar in 2007. Other than the king, I've made a career out of playing bad guys, and to me he just seemed like the ultimate bad guy. And there was a regalness about his bearing, and kind of Asian in its sensibilities, and I liked that very much. And the whole power of less is more. Because you notice Quan Chi never shouts. He's always like very sure of himself, very quiet. Oh, it's nice to see you. And people who have the power don't need to shout. Now, of course, in the fighting, of course, I spent like an hour just shouting and grunting and screaming and as you know, we do for all of the reaction shots. But generally, he's a pretty smooth customer. And you employing that as a way to honestly or dishonestly get what he wants is very appealing. You get to explore that side of oneself.
Yes. Quan Chi is a very important character to you, clearly. You've mentioned before that you are always mesmerized by some of the other takes on the combatant within the franchise. Did you happen to see Richard DeVizio's portrayal in MK Mythologies or Adonis Maropas' performance on the TV show MK Conquest?
Oh, I have not. I'm so sorry.
Oh, you should definitely check them out. They do a great job as well. It's pretty interesting.
Oh, I'm sure. I have heard there's like behind the voice actors, and I've gone and I've listened to other interpretations of the role, and I think they're all wonderful, absolutely, and every actor brings something different to a role and allows a whole new generation to discover the character and the setting, the game itself. It's just, and for me, it's like, you know, I love that interpretation. I'm going to steal that for next time, kind of a thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What would you say, in your opinion, are some of Quan Chi's most memorable lines? So would you be willing to activate your inner Quan Chi and deliver some of your favorites?
I just like the iconic finish him. Finish him.
Well, you can't go wrong with that.
Yeah. I got to be honest with you, I don't remember a lot of the lines themselves. So.
Sure. Yeah. That's a classic. After playing Quan Chi for three consecutive games, when you read in the script that the sorcerer was finally, apparently, going to meet his end, how did you feel about that? Were you a little saddened by it? And how do you think that scene played out in the end? Were you satisfied?
I was. You asked me earlier what my favorite... the final moves, the
killing moves, abilities and finishers,
Were my favorites. I did watch that scene a couple of times, and I thought, wow. Because he gets his groin stomped on and gets stuff pulled out. And and I thought, the teenager in me went, man, that's really cool. Kind of a thing. Well, because you probably remember the controversy surrounding Mortal Kombat and the level of violence. And the thing is, it's become so hyper-real. I'm not sure which animation engine is used on it, but it's so real. And even the quote-unquote gore that we see in movies today, I saw Bullet Train last night, it's done so artistically that I've worked as a nurse. I've seen real gore. What? For me, it's easy to separate the two. And it almost becomes artistic, like the fight scene in movies and television are as much dances as they are actual fighting. They're very, very, very choreographed and a testament to the abilities and the athleticism and artistry of those who are performing them. So the same thing with the animation of Mortal Kombat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if Quan Chi was to return in a future installment, which I think pretty much everyone knows he will, and if you were asked to reprise your role, what direction would you like to see the character go? For example, would you be interested in maybe seeing like a prequel where perhaps we might see, you know, Quan Chi's rise to power in the Netherrealm?
That sounds interesting. In hearing your question, I realized I didn't answer the previous one. Did I feel sad when it ended? No, I kind of felt that, first of all, in this universe, these kinds of games and these kinds of stories, nobody stays dead. Nobody stays dead. If they want him back, he'll be back. And I'm very much of a do the job, and if it leads to something else, great. If not, you know, we move on, and there's something else in store for me. So I didn't feel sad at all. And I started to get to the age where I really like the idea of handing off. I've had my chance to experience it and to offer my take on it, and let's hand it off and see what the next person has about it.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So what was your question? The question right now that you asked, and then when I went back to the previous one.
Where would you like to see the character go, basically? Would you like to see him evolve a little bit, or
would you be interested in a prequel?
Yeah, if they asked you back, would you come
I'm
back?
Like Chris Rock. I don't care if I'm like the fifth person they chose, give me the job. So yeah, I'd be thrilled to go back, be invited back and have a chance to do it if I have the time. There's a lot of things going on in my life right now that are non-voiceover related, including going back to nursing and taking care of family members. But yeah, if they would be willing, I would be willing. Absolutely.
Right. Very nice.
And as for seeing where the character goes, I got to tell you guys, I have no opinion on that. I'd like to be surprised and inspired by whatever. Because this is not my story. Quan Chi is not my story. I'm the person who brings the story to life. But the writers of the story are the ones who get to determine whether or not we're going to do a prequel, or he's going to come back, you know, 10 years later and he's using a walker and he's living in a an old Mortal Kombat home. So,
well said.
In the games, each time Quan Chi does, say, a projectile attack or simply uses his magic, you hear him say certain phrases in what must be his native tongue in the Netherrealm. Did the team at NRS direct you to say things specifically, or was there a bit of improvisation there? Because when we had Tom Choi on the show, he told us they originally got him to say very particular words extremely fast when performing his moves, say. So.
No, they didn't. They actually asked me to make up a language on the spot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was at once thrilling and scary. at the center. And when I heard it played back, because I've done a lot of singing in churches and temples around, I thought, ooh, gosh, that sounds very Hebrew. I hope I don't offend anyone, kind of thing. So it's like...
Now, that's pretty cool. I did not know that.
So you mentioned previously that you spent a good amount of time grunting and making strange noises, and you referred to the scene where Sonya Blade crushes Quan Chi's nuts. was that part of the job, a little taxing on your vocal cords?
Or oh, yeah. Was it,
yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And it can be. My voice is pretty trained. I've been trained for 4-hour operas and 8 shows a week. And it still is taxing. And I also teach voice, so it's something I would say if a student said, okay, I've got this kind of a gear, I say, okay, remember to support, remember to use good technique, and find ways to create those sounds without hurting your voice. But sometimes they want you to go to places that are definitely can harm your voice. And as an actor, you have to make that decision right then, without, okay, I'm going to do this for the job, and if it ruins my voice, I accept that, kind of a thing. There's stories in the opera world of an opera singer named Maria Callas, who put a lot of emotion into her opera singing. And up until that point, opera singing was very, very specific in how you created the sound, and it was a healthy sound. With her, she put her emotions ahead of it and became absolutely famous for it, but it cost her, especially in her later life. She could not sing as long into her career because of those kinds of things she did to her voice. So again, it's the decision of the performer. Sometimes it's a tough decision to make because you want to please the director. So to answer your question, yeah, it was a little taxing, but if I could do 8 shows a week or a 4 or 5 hour opera, I can grunt and scream for about, you know, an hour and recover from it. So.
Mm-hmm.
I did.
Yeah. When you did do those stints, was it towards the end of the day or?
It was.
Like, okay.
Yeah. And they know if they want the beautiful, quiet, deeply resonant parts, you don't put the screaming and the yelling in front because your chords get fried, and then it starts to sound, it sounds like a tired voice.
Yes,
it doesn't have anywhere near the resonance or the ping that they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Here at Kamidogu, we always like to hear each of the actors' unique experience of what it was like working in NetherRealm Studios. We're aware you, of course, worked closely with Dominic Cianciolo, but who were some other people at this studio who really made it a memorable working environment, and what are some of the good times that will never fade away in your mind?
The biggest one was the first Mortal Kombat, the DC Universe. There was a very, very kind audio engineer named Morgan Gerhard, who said to me, geez, you're really great. I can't believe that you don't belong to a voiceover agency. And I said, yeah, I just have my regular agent. And he passed away a couple of years later. And Morgan took me under his wing. And he said, hey, I know this guy, Tom Lawless, over at Vox. I'm going to sort of mention you to him. And he did that. And really, I would not have the wonderful agency I have today still, even though I'm kind of semi-retired, without Morgan. And Morgan's so cool. He was a wonderful audio engineer, but he also does kind of Cirque du Soleil acrobatic type things. He works with Erica Linz, who was in one of the Cirque du Soleil Worlds Apart that came out, I think, in like 2012. So, yeah, that's, and I have fond memories. I'm so grateful to Morgan.
Very nice.
I guess another memorable incident in, I can't remember which one it was. It might have been the last one. It might have been Mortal Kombat X, where I actually didn't have a director in the studio with me. The director, it was, I guess, early days of some sort of form of Source Connect, where it was just a voice. coming out of my headphones.
Mm, wow.
And he was in New York. So.
Wow.
Hmm, interesting. What's some advice that you would give to somebody who's perhaps looking into delving into the world of voice acting? Perhaps some tips. And would you say it's been helpful? Would you say it would be helpful to start your journey in a closet with a studio?
Let's see. Well, I'll answer that backwards. Yes, I think it is. Because of the pandemic, and even before the pandemic, we were heading towards, because of technology, we were heading towards the ability for people to have studios in their home of a quality that can make a copy acceptable to movies and video games and the rest. So that was coming down the pipeline. The pandemic just sped that up. Is it necessary to have that right away? You can actually... As I'm sure you well know, there are resources all over the internet, advice on voice actors on setting up a home studio that maybe it's not good enough to lay down a whole track for a video game or a dubbing for a movie, but it's certainly sufficient for auditioning, and it makes auditioning so much easier, convenient, and less expensive. It cost me a tank of gas to go up to North Hollywood every time I needed to do a little bit of an audition. So, but when I was working at Disney, I had younger potential voice artists, actors, wannabe voice actors, come up to me and ask me what to do. One of them asked me to set it up with my agency. And I was a little bit reluctant about that because whatever we do, we are judged by, you know, our word becomes an important part and of who we are. And we want to make sure that we maintain a certain standard. But the thing I found most with voice actors who want to be voice actors is that they've actually got the little studio and they've got a decent mic and they've got the technical stuff down. They know how to work with a microphone,
right,
but they don't know how to act. So my biggest advice for up-and-coming voice actors is learn how to act, and you do that by doing it. Yes, you can go to a school, but you need to, when you're not in the booth, you know, working on your technique, you need to be out and getting any sort of acting job you can, learning how to formulate a character, how to deliver lines, how to adjust your performance based on what the director wants or what's going on with the audience. That's because who are they hiring? And for the big gigs, they're hiring already established actors.
Mm.
And, you know, if they're celebrities, it's a money-making business. Celebrities in musical theater put butts in seats. Celebrities on your video game or in your movie will help to increase the bottom line. So, but for young voice actors, it's get out and act and be as as varied in what you do as you possibly can, because all of that will go into what you're going to do in front of the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and the big thing, I guess if we want to talk about philosophy, do it because you love to do it. Not because you want to become a famous YouTuber or you want to become a famous actor or a famous anything. Do it because you love to do it. And if you stop loving to do it, start thinking of other things that you might want to do instead.
That's the way. You've done a lot of Broadway major theater productions, as we know. You performed the role of Sweeney Todd, Jafar and Aladdin, along with the King of Siam. For the production of The King and I, what are some of the best experiences you have had in this field and the few of the things that you have learned along the way there?
Oh, wow. There have been so many amazing experiences. I got to work with a singer named Debbie Boone, who is just an absolute sweetheart. She sang a very famous song from my youth in the 1970s called You Light Up My Life. And it won the Grammy that year, and she became famous. She's the daughter of Pat Boone. I got to work with her on a couple of King and I's. And the chemistry between us was such that it was just an absolute joy to come to work with her every single night. Doing Sweeney Todd was also absolutely thrilling and scary, but it was a role I enjoyed. I guess another kind of a bad guy, and that was with East West Players, who were famous for their production, their original production of Sweeney Todd, years and years ago, I think back in the 90s or something like that.
Okay.
East West Players here in LA has a very special connection to the late Stephen Sondheim, as it was started by an actor named Mako, who Sondheim called upon to play the lead in a show called Pacific Overtures about the opening of Japan. And because I am Japanese, that was one of the first musical theater albums. My mom, I heard all the Broadway albums, South Pacific, My Fair Lady, Man of the Manch, things like that. But when I became an adult, the first one I heard was Pacific Overtures. And so to go to that theater, supported by Sondheim and started by the first American Mako to be nominated for an Academy Award, that was thrilling, to be a part of history. And that was one of the things we all wish, I think, as performers, or even what you guys do, to step into that stream of consciousness that is musical theater, acting, podcasting, and offer our talents and see it become a part of the history of those mediums.
Yeah. Your acting credits on IMDb shows a project called The Mocking Dead in 2013. we've looked at various places online, but we could only find a comic book series of this name and some other fan-made YouTube videos. Did you, in fact, work on this project where you would take on the role of Daryl Dixon?
Yes, it was a parody of course, The Walking Dead, and so I had to go in there and try to be this character who... Other than they gave me a couple of referential videos to follow because I didn't. Guys, I'm so lame. I didn't watch Walking Dead either. but again, you know, as an actor, you do what they ask you to do. The first thing, I don't know anything about The Walking Dead. That doesn't instill confidence in the people who have hired you. So you just say, okay, yeah, I'll give it my best shot. And so. Yeah, and it was a cute little a parody that they I must have a copy of it somewhere on a hard drive somewhere, but it's interesting that it's on IMDb, but you can't find it.
Yeah, I couldn't find it anywhere. Did they tell you it was going to be on any particular platform or anything? Or
no, they didn't.
Well, I would love to see that. I mean, you played Daryl Dixon?
Yeah. It was really cute. It was really hilarious. And it was very, very short. I think they used Legos.
Oh!
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure The Mocking Dead used Legos.
Wow.
Have you tried that, looking it up with Mocking Dead and Legos?
No, but I'm going to do that now.
No, we can.
That's fantastic.
I found it. Yeah.
Oh,
Oh, really?
The Mocking Dead Lego parody on YouTube.
Oh, that is amazing. Yes, I'm going to give that a watch right after. Yep. We'll make sure to put it in the show notes.
Right. And it was such a short little thing, and it came and went so fast that I haven't actually even thought about it in years and years. And it was back in
2013.
2013. Yeah.
10 years ago.
So, you know, it's funny. One of the reasons you may not be able to find it, it might be that... Because what's on there now is the preview, and I think I only remember recording the preview. So that may have been all that there was of The Mocking Dead. So anyway, I think you'll like it. It's pretty goofy.
I'm going to search and search. Just before we get to the final segment of the show, I'm aware that you are also a massive Simpsons fan, which is an incredibly huge IP that's been around for years and years. I understand you actually sent in an audition for the show. Is this something that you could possibly expand on? Were you trying to push for a certain role at the time, or what did your audition entail?
It was an episode that aired last year, and I actually just I got the audition notice from my agency. They just sent me in, and I was like, I think I emailed a bunch of family members and friends saying, hey, I finally got an audition for The Simpsons. But it was for a role of an Asian who, when it aired, looked like he was the Dalai Lama or something. But it was only like two words. It was really, really short. Man. Yeah.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. So it sort of came and went, and I didn't get it. So,
but you're still pushing for it. You got to get
it. Absolutely. I keep getting sent stuff that I'm thinking, wow, I never thought I'd be a part of that. And
all right, so now we're going to switch things up a little bit. We're going to go to a segment called
Final Round.
So what we're going to do for this final round is sort of ask you some fun, quick questions, but don't stress yourself out. There's no time limit or anything like this. So the first question being, what are some of your secret talents?
Oh, wow. Secret talents.
Yeah, do you have any hobbies on the side that a lot of people don't know? Yeah, tell us something we don't know.
Brad, I should have come up with this. This would be a part of my elevator speech. Let's see. Secret talents. No, I'm not sure I have any. I mean...
Okay, that's fine.
I guess a secret talent would be that I'm sort of an up-and-coming writer. Okay. So I've done some scripts for Pacific Symphony. In fact, I'm doing one right now for their Lunar New Year concert coming up in a couple of weeks, which I MC, and so they let me write my own scripts for that. But I believe heavily in education and outreach. So it's probably on my resume, but most people, that's not the first thing they think of. I can sing in a lot of different languages because I was in opera. And because I sang, I was invited to sing for a lot of different churches, including Jewish temples. So singing Hebrew and there's a Japanese church down in downtown LA that hired me to do Handel's Messiah in Japanese. So I have a certain facility with languages, nothing like the amazing voice actors on The Simpsons or anything, but, a little bit of that. I think if I don't paint or draw. I play the flute. I haven't played it in years, but I play the flute. So.
Okay. Very good, very good. If you had to pick, what would you say is your favorite food of all time?
Sushi.
We get that one so much, Akris. So much.
Even as a kid, and we were totally American, you know, potato salad and steak, but every once in a while, you know, we'd do takeout sushi, or we'd go to this really cool traditional Japanese restaurant down in San Diego called Miyako's, where they had performers, ladies dressed like geishas and playing the shamisen, and even as a kid, I thought, this is just so cool.
Yeah.
And then even, you know, as a kid, you think, oh, kid's never going to like sushi. I loved it.
What is your favorite childhood memory?
My favorite childhood memory was waking up one morning and my father and mother announcing to me, we lived in San Diego at the time, that we were going to Disneyland. For some reason, I was so excited, I couldn't eat breakfast. I was just out of my mind. And the thing is, I didn't have a lot of memories of Disney as a kid, other than, you know, seeing the cartoons and going to see the animated films. I was actually 4 years old when my dad took us to the World's Fair in New York where Disney had a big presence. Mm-hmm. This was just after Disneyland had opened, and Walt was trying out a bunch of stuff. And that childhood memory came back to me when I became a guided tour guide at Disneyland, and they talked about, in the Walking Walt's Footsteps tour, the impact that the World's Fair had on getting attractions built, like the mine train that goes around, not the mine train, but the train that goes around the park that goes through the dinosaur land and the submarines and the Matterhorn bobsleds, all came from something that I was at as a little boy and didn't have much memory of. But again, on that morning, it must have been 1970, I think. I don't know. It was, we're going to Disneyland. Actually, you know, as a kid, I don't remember anything about going to Disneyland that day. I just remember that I was so happy we were going. And I got to relive that. Yeah. And no eating breakfast. But I got to relive that when I was cast as Jafar in the Aladdin show. Because I had been on tour. I had been on tour for 5 years. And all of a sudden, to work for the place where they create happiness, where dreams come true, to work for that and to be 20 minutes from my home and have full benefits and get paid. Oh my goodness. It was just, it was reliving my childhood all over again. And I got to play the bad guy. So.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're like, they're the most fun to play in the Disney, in the Disney movies. They have all the best lines and
they really do.
What every actor loves is having a death scene, and all of the Disney villains, if they don't, you know, they don't always get killed, but they often get their comeuppance. It's just, there's something cool about that. The fairy tale would not work without that part of it.
What is the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Love what you do and do what you love.
Well said.
Very nice. Well said. Very nice. What is your favorite color?
Red.
Red.
Very nice. I was thinking of wearing red, but the shirt was in the laundry and didn't want to.
It is what it is.
That's the great thing about voiceover. You can show up in a dirty shirt that stinks and nobody knows.
That's true.
Especially what is with your home favorite? Studios. If you're in the regular studio,
Well, I mean, if you're in the closet, sound engineer, reach out and change if you need to.
That's right. Did you get the funk that was in the booth after he left? Oh my god!
What's your favorite place to vacation?
England. My dad's family is from the UK, though I didn't learn about this until much later in my life. My dad's mom is Italian, but then I learned later on that my dad's dad, his family was from the United Kingdom. So, and I went there in 1977, right after I graduated from high school, on a tour that was a drama tour. So we were based in London for 3 weeks. I studied drama during the day at the London University. Every night I was in the theater. And then we had a tour of the country, and I've been back a couple of times. But it's, I'm dyed-in-the-wool Anglophile. I just love everything English, Irish, or Scottish. And so that's kind of my favorite place. And the thing is, very special right now because my wife and I, we're going to go in 2020, visit the United Kingdom for our 20th anniversary trip. And of course, you know what happened in 2020. So we're hopefully going to get it done this year in October. So we'll see. We're making the plan, so. Yes. Yeah, we got most of our money back, but not all of it. The airline didn't give our money back, so.
Oh.
Yeah, I think a lot of
folks. What are you going to do? I mean, so.
Yeah.
They look pretty desperate right now, so I don't mind donating to. Well, not donating, but them keeping my money.
Yeah.
I mean, it's gone. What am I going to do? You know, I could get a resentment over it, but what's the point?
Yeah. This next question is kind of ironic, but if you stumbled upon a genie that would grant you 3 wishes, what would your 3 wishes be?
That's great. Let's see, what I want. You know, it's funny, a genie can offer you something that at first look appears to be something very precious and a great blessing, but almost every wish comes with a cost in some way or another. I think I would pretty much keep it simple, and that I think the first thing I would wish for is that everyone in the world could find their own happiness. The second wish would be good health for everyone, and lastly would be I wish that everyone realize the importance of accepting impermanence, that nothing lasts forever. Mm-hmm. And the sooner we accept that, that's what I believe is one of the keys to happiness.
Very true. All right.
And you wanted to hear, question. Though, you wanted to hear cast in Quan Chi as Quan Chi again, right? That's not-
It was in the back of our minds.
Holy.
Damn, this guy is
metaphysical. What is he? Couldn't just wish for money? What is the deal here? Come on, man. So, I don't know. You get philosophical as you get older, right? Well, more philosophical. I don't want to say young people aren't philosophical be attacked on social media or anything, but it's like, you get a bit philosophical and you start to your experiences allow you to make some firmer choices on what matters and what doesn't. So
that's it. And final question, what are you most proud of?
Oh, wow.
So whether it's your career, voicing Quan Chi, your life in general.
I'm most proud of the fact that I have gotten to and still get to on one hand, help people, care for people, and my work as a nurse, and I also work for a mentorship program. And on the other hand, having been able to move people, inspire them through what I've done in entertainment, whether it be opera, voiceover, acting. So I think if, you know, the chips are being added up at the end of my life, say, well, here's in the positive column. So
yes,
nice,
very good. Well, Ron,
I know you're saying why couldn't he say money?
Oh, for real, this has been a great experience. I can't say it enough. Thank you so much for being here. But before we go today, is there any type of project you'd like to promote at this time? I know you said you were working on your writing. And where can fans find you on social media?
Social media, I have a Facebook page. I have a very minimal presence on Instagram and Twitter. So, at Ronlyn Banks, I think is Twitter, Instagram. I don't remember. But if you Google my name, it's pretty easy to find me. So I'm the only Ronlyn. I pop up first when you type in Ronlyn Banks. it's a little harder to find me if you type in Ron Banks, because there are several Ron Bankses. Including a jazz singer out of Detroit who recently passed away. Oh. So, but only one Ronald M. Banks. So,
okay.
I want to thank you guys. I just want to take a moment to thank you guys. It was an honor to participate in this, and just very flattering after all these years. Because the last time I was a part of Mortal Kombat was 2015, And yet,
yeah,
you and the fans are keeping this art form and this game that gives people, so many people, still gives so many people pleasure alive. It's just, it's quite an honor to be a part of that. So thank you very much.
Well, your portrayal was certainly iconic, and it lives on. And we have our fingers crossed that we see you in a future game.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was lots of fun. Always super exciting to learn new things about the greatest franchise of all time. Ronald is nothing short of a legend for his spectacular work, and we truly hope he'll return again as the Sorcerer sooner than later. We appreciate you taking the time today. We still got more amusing interviews on the horizon. Keep your eyes peeled, combatants. Until next time, have fun, stay safe, and
stay flawless.